Hello, I am Marcia Links Qualey, and here we are at the Off London Book Fair podcast. And I'm with now with Omid Tofikian, who is a lecturer in philosophy, formerly at the American University in Cairo, now adjunct lecturer at New South Wales, also honorary associate at University of Sydney, a researcher, community advocate, and accidental literary translator. He's the author of Myth and Philosophy in Platonic Dialogues and translator of Behrouz Boochani's multi-award-winning book, No Friend But the Mountains, Writing from Manus Prison, and co-editor of Refugee Filmmaking, Alphaville Journal of Film and Screen Media. And just wanted to start out by you reading from your translation to sort of set the tone.
First of all, thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you.
This passage is from chapter 7 in No Friend But the Mountains. Now, I should mention that at a certain point, the passage moves from prose to verse.
Okay.
So I'll give it a little signal when that happens, so that the reader knows that
yes.
We're switching format. On some days, when the clouds are thinner than usual, or the sky is filled with only sparse pockets of cloud, the heat in the tunnel reaches temperatures that could cook a human body. Prisoners are like pieces of meat in a metal pressure cooker. During the day, almost no one dares sleep or lie down on their beds inside the tunnel. No one even feels like sitting down inside because every second spent in there means experiencing heat that sears eyeballs. There is an alternative. The prisoners find sanctuary under a single old tree with wide leaves that stands between the dining area and the small room erected for no clear purpose at the top of the compound. This thick tree generously spreads its branches across the whole area. Like the cool shade of an umbrella, it comforts many of the distressed men from the tunnel. The shaded space is filled with plastic chairs. The prisoners sit there, leaning back on the chairs. Move to verse. Killing time involves a simple trick. Reach out and hold another sunset, another one of the thousand color Manusian sunsets. Then reach out and hold another night, another one of the dark island nights. A futile cycle, night and day revolving. Under the shade of an old tree. Back to prose. In some periods during the middle of the day, not even a bit of water-bearing tropical cloud emerges in the sky. The temperature reaches its peak. Verse. Two suns are in battle, one descending from the sky, one ascending from earth, searing, extremely bright, reaching total domination. Prose. When the sun and the earth come together as one, places of shade become rare and the prisoners gather under the shade of the old tree, like baby chickens sheltering under the wings of their mother. The popos and Australian officers work incessantly and monitor back and forth all throughout the prisons. The faces of Australians, bright red faces, blood red faces. Australians with fat asses, sweaty ass cracks flowing right like rivers. It seems that even sunglasses are defeated, and the mosquitoes, what intelligent creatures. They have disappeared, living beings that evade the light, precise and quick in the dark.
That's wonderful, thank you. So my understanding is that you started out by translating some of Behrouz's journalistic pieces, but how did that come about?
Well, first of all, I should mention that I've been working in this particular space supporting displaced exiled peoples in Australia and in other parts of the world, collaborating with them on different levels since the early 2000s. Before that, I mean, of course, my own experience of displacement and exile also encouraged me, motivated me to do this kind of work. But at that point in the early 2000s, I became politically active. And it was only at the beginning of 2016 and that I read one of Petrus's articles, translated by his first translator, Munis Mansoubi, who lives in Sydney. And it was published in The Guardian. And it was the first time he published under his real name and the first time he published in The Guardian. So when I read that article through the networks that I was involved in, it was shared on social media, I thought, why don't I know about this person? Why isn't he a central part of the discussion? How come he's not more better known?
Right.
At that point, I thought that I'd find him online, and I found his Facebook page or his Facebook account. I sent him a message, and at the beginning of 2016, phones were contraband, and the reception was awful in the prison. They were extremely remote, and he wasn't opening up a lot of messages from people he didn't know, but I got lucky. He opened up mine, started a conversation. We moved from Facebook to WhatsApp. And I started translating journalism, and then later, in 2016, at the end, I started on the book, and the rest is history.
Right. And where were you living at the time?
At that time, I was in Sydney.
Okay.
And it was around the middle of 2017, just, I think, August 2017, that I moved to Cairo.
Okay.
So the translation of the book was partly in Sydney, partly in Cairo, and also partly on Manus Island when I went to visit Behrouz.
Right. I mean, the way you describe it in pieces that I've read about it, it seems like a much more of a collaborative process, a co-authoring process almost, of this experimental translation versus the translator working on a text.
It may seem that way, but I think it's really important to define this. Even though it's a collaborative project, there's definitely an author and there's definitely a translator. And it's so difficult and so complex to explain this particular collaborative work that it often it blurs those categories,
right.
blurs those roles. So Behrouz wrote the whole book on WhatsApp,
right,
by text message. And he sent those text messages to Munis Mansoubi. And so he was writing it from the very first phase of his incarceration on Manus Island within the first few months, when he got a contraband phone smuggled in. So he sent the messages ranging from about one paragraph to two pages to Munis Mansoubi, and based on his instructions, she would put these passages into chapters. And so when I came onto the project, Behrouz had written about 30% of the book, so the early chapters, and Munis emailed me PDFs of those chapters. So when I received those, I was looking at every chapter, which was one long text message.
Right. Wow.
And so I had to edit and translate at the same time. And I guess this is where the confusion comes about in terms of, what kind of collaboration took place. So he had written the whole chapter. I was translating. But while I was translating, he was sending me messages directly asking me to add particular passages in different parts of the chapters. So then they became even more complex and there were more layers. And then we were talking on a daily basis, and sometimes we'd talk for a long period about one word or one sentence or one section. And so that ended up changing. And we never made these changes to the original Farsi. We only made them to the translation.
See.
So it gets even more confusing and harder to explain.
Right. So the original ends up being different from the English translation, but both his products.
Exactly, exactly. And while I was translating the early chapters, he was writing the middle chapters. Mm-hmm. Then while I was translating the middle chapters, he was writing the last chapters. And the final chapter, chapter 12, is really interesting because he was writing that while the prison was under siege for 23 days. So he'd started it before. He couldn't finish it during the siege, obviously, because he was writing a diary. I was translating on a daily basis. The situation was extraordinarily horrific. And then when he was forcibly evicted from the original prison and put into newer prisons in another part of Manus Island, that's when he finally finished that last chapter. And he didn't send that one to Munis in pieces. That one he wrote completely. and then sent it to me by text message. So the last chapter has a unique character to it, a unique quality to it.
Right. So in two different places, so I just have to admit that my sort of when I imagine a philosophy professor, it is not somebody engaged in work with refugees or literary translation or I guess anything about the contemporary world. So this is very wrong of me. And
I should mention though, I think you're actually right. I'm very much on the fringes of academia and especially in philosophy. So I see myself in many ways as a counter philosophy, a counter philosopher.
Okay. Because I was interested in how philosophy informs your process both with work with refugees and debordering and with literary translation. I saw in two different places you called it a form of shared philosophical activity. Yeah. And I guess I wanted to know, what does that mean?
Okay, yeah, that's a very good question. I think one of the things that connected me with Behrouz, and even though I've been working with other refugees, other migrants who were involved in intellectual and creative work, there was something about Behrouz's work that really connected with me and drew me in a way that I'd never experienced before. And I think it was the multi-layers of meaning associated with his work and the way that his vision, his way of being, his way of thinking was in itself a debordering practice. I identified it as a debordering practice. So he blurs the boundaries between literature, theoretical work, intellectual work, artistic work, myth and folklore and history, and even I think a lot of his work I could describe as psychoanalytic examinations of you know, the human condition. And so there's so much in Behrouz's work that overlaps and blurs boundaries. And in fact, I call his work in many respects, especially his literature, an anti-genre. And so when I was working with him, and as we were working towards one particular goal, we started to understand each other a lot better. Our understanding or our notion of political action and transformation really started to merge in important ways. I saw what we were doing as a shared philosophical activity, because in philosophy there's interesting discussions, interesting work done on multiple identities, one body, multiple selves.
Right.
Whereas here in this case, what I was seeing between Behrouz and myself and also other people that we were working in conjunction with was many bodies, one mind. Mm-hmm. So there was kind of a shared or a collective intentionality, shared agency. And I think this particular project opens up new questions and philosophical questions, I mean, on top of all of the other political, literary, intellectual issues. It says some interesting things about philosophy and opens up new, philosophical subjects or philosophical themes that can be expanded. And I think at this point we see an interesting connection between lived experience, activism, and philosophical work.
So I was also reading this, the refugee filmmaking, and in your introduction, when you talk about how we deborder, mm-hmm. you were talking about how centering writers and artists impacted by border violence. And I just wanted to know what are some of the ways that people working in literature can move towards debordering? What are some of better practices and worse practices?
Well, maybe I'll start by giving an example of the early period when I was working with Behrouz. He was writing amazing journalism. He was reporting from inside the detention center. He was he was analyzing the prison system, and he was developing this really astute, really profound insight into the way that state violence works. However, for many years there was no infrastructure, no capacity, and also maybe no tradition or culture within Australian media to accommodate what Behrouz was doing. First of all, it was extraordinarily hard for him to find translators. He talks often to me about how he was humiliated by journalists early on in his writing. They didn't consider him a journalist. He couldn't break through the stereotype of a refugee, someone who's passive, maybe weak, broken, inept. He was always being interpreted in terms of deficit.
Right, and they're there to tell his story.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so for a long time, he was actually, the writing that he was doing, the reporting that he was doing, was referred to by other journalists, he was acknowledged as an unidentified source.
Wow.
And even when he found a translator and wanted to publish his work in media outlets, he was told on a number of occasions that, we can't publish this. This is not good enough, you know. And it was The Guardian that really gave him his first opportunity, major opportunity to show what he's capable of. But still, I think it was around 3 years before he really started to gather a network of people around him and really start to get the attention that he deserves. And I have to say, it wasn't until the 23-day siege when he was writing those diary entries.
I remember those.
Yeah. Published in The Guardian as well, and also his work in the Saturday paper. Mm. So that really sort of launched him into a completely new sphere, and he acquired a really special and larger readership. But of course, the book coming out was phenomenal, but also winning the award, the Victorian Prize for Literature. I guess I'm explaining all of this to say that do we have the right kind of infrastructure? Do we have the right kind of networks? Is there the right vision within supporters for refugees to actually allow for these kinds of voices, these kinds of insights to come in and actually lead to make decisions, to teach us about what state violence is about, what the state is capable of, and what kind of mechanisms of control and domination and subjugation are being experimented on people who are considered non-citizens, undesirable, because this then impacts the citizen. You know, there's a relationship between the border and the citizen.
Right, absolutely, if not now, later.
Exactly.
So some of the things, there need to be more translators who can translate his work, but then also sort of like a mindset change.
Absolutely. I think, and what I said earlier about the kind of perception or the stereotype of a refugee as passive, broken, weak, needy. Mm-hmm. The refugee is always, the definition or the understanding of a refugee is always in contrast to the citizen. And that is determined by this kind of deficit surplus dichotomy. So the refugee is always seen as someone who's going to be a drain. Someone who is going to need extra assistance, which, I mean, of course, it's true, but we all need assistance. We all need support in different ways. I think this particular perception of refugees undermines the fact that they can contribute something that we'll never be able to acquire because of our citizen privilege.
Right. So I also wanted to ask about how you talked about this absolute or radical openness as part of the experimental process of translating it, and how you intended to bring that into your future work as well, sort of what that meant for the process of creating this work and what future projects you're looking at.
One of the things that I've been influenced by in my philosophical work is research in social epistemology, particularly an area called epistemic injustice.
Mm-hmm.
So in epistemic injustice, there are a range of different forms of oppression. One of them is regarding testimony. So the way that testimonies are interpreted, the way they're evaluated, the way that they're used, or the way they're compounded with other forms of speech acts. The other one is what's called hermeneutical injustice, where in this case you don't need a perpetrator and a victim. It's structural. The problem is structural. And there are a range of other forms of epistemic injustice, but these two are the better known forms of epistemic injustice. Now, In terms of radical openness, I think one of them needs to be about how we engage, how we understand, how we incorporate testimonies. It's remarkable that journalists will write about what's happening in detention centres, the kind of violence that takes place, only when there's a particular kind of evidence provided.
Mm.
Whereas refugees have been giving testimonies about what they go through for years and years, but that's not considered legitimate evidence. It seems like only when a particular kind of study is done, or a particular, news outlet releases information, it's only at that point that suddenly people, maybe unconsciously or subconsciously, really start to take this seriously and consider it as, a contribution to knowledge.
Right. We
don't have the kind of the appreciation of the knowledge that is embodied in the refugee who is within the detention centre, who is contained, incarcerated, and subject to systematic torture, which is another important point. Behrouz has been talking about what's happening in these spaces for a long time as systematic torture, but even people who are sympathetic towards refugees and supportive of refugees were really unsure exactly what he meant by that and whether it was the right way to describe what was happening to people in those sites. And I think a lot of this has to do with testimonial injustice. With hermeneutical injustice, we have to even go further in terms of the openness, the radical openness, and start to think, what kind of concepts, definitions, theoretical frameworks are we using? What kind of symbolic aesthetic is conditioning the way we're engaging and strategizing in order to transform border violence or dismantle border violence, I should say. So in that respect, we need to think about the structures and the conditions that create knowledge, allow for knowledge, and determine what is considered valid and invalid. So, this kind of radical openness requires, a transformation on so many different levels, intellectually, artistically, socially, politically, economically, but it fundamentally comes down to the way knowledge is produced and what is considered knowledge.
Mm. And so what are you working on? To sort of wrap up, what are you working on now?
At the moment, planning on a book about the translation of the book.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, thank you. I realize that every time I have engaged in interviews or seminars or conferences, I can never quite explain sufficiently what it took to make this book. And again, leading to some of the confusions about, is this co-authorship or is it what kind of collaborative work is it? What role did you play? Who else was involved?
Right.
What do you mean by shared philosophical activity? I can never explain that sufficiently. Mm. There's always gaps in my account. So I think that, and also the fact that the book is part of like a longer project, which goes back to when I first met Behrouz. Even before I met Behrouz, the work I was doing with other displaced and exiled peoples, and even going back to the stories that I heard growing up about family members and friends who were in these sorts of conditions. So all of these played a major role in the translation of the book. And then while I was translating the book, there was his journalism, there was the subtitles for his film, there was speeches and tweets and all sorts of things that we were working on together. So also the multi-layers of meaning in the book, all this notion of anti-genre, what does that mean, and what other forms of knowledge are actually intertwined and working in conjunction with each other to create what we have now, which is a remarkable piece of literature. To explain all of that, I really need a book. I really need to write a book about it.
Well, it's just, it was fantastically fortunate, though, that he found you as the sort of a reader and then as a translator of the book, rather than all these people beforehand saying, well, this doesn't fit, this isn't good enough because it's not exactly how we would see it, versus looking at what it is instead of what it isn't.
Yeah. And Behrouz and I talk about that, and I say, when he says that it's, I'm lucky that I found you and we were able to not only work together, but also have like very deep conversations and engage in a lot of critical analysis. And I say to veterans, one of the things I love about working with him is that it completely disrupts this victim-savior binary that is associated with refugee supporters or a lot of interaction between citizens and refugees. And I say to veterans that you've actually done more for me.
Right.
I'm the one that's really benefited in many ways from this collaboration. And a lot of my philosophical work and a lot of the research that I was doing before meeting Behrouz really enhanced as a result of interacting with him and translating for him. The other work that I'm planning on doing is writing another academic book about epistemology and displacement and exile as philosophical standpoints or positions, and also the role of pride in, so there's some really interesting work in social epistemology about how pride actually creates new ways of seeing and knowing and new ways of interacting, and also it must be seen as a political act as well. So I think with the work that Behrouz is doing, one of the things that I'm extremely pleased with and I think has so much potential is the way that the celebration of his book, the joy generated as a result of the awards, the hope that it's created, and also the pride associated with it are political acts.
Right.
So again, going back to this idea of openness, thinking about these things that are not, in some respects may not be seen as being explicitly political, making them integral to political action.
Excellent. Thank you, Omid, for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course, at this off London Book Fair event.